Hi, welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we're speaking with Gary L. Francione, a professor and an author of many different books. We have a lot of interviews with Professor Francione, so if you're interested in hearing more from him, of course, he has a very developed website, too, that we'll reference at the end of the program. But you can also go to animalvoices.ca and check out our various interviews with Francione over the years. Before the break, I was mentioning to Gary that I would love to hear more about some of the critiques that he has, some very specific critiques about some of the welfare legislation that's been passed and how this has been heralded by some as being a victory for animals. And one of the repeated arguments throughout the book that you make, Gary, is that if welfare measures worked, and we've been doing this, people have been doing animal welfare type work for a really long time, we would see a really big drastic drop in animal exploitation, or things would be getting better. And of course you point out that actually things are getting worse. And I think that some people would say, well, if it weren't for all those animal welfare laws and regulations and statutes, etc., then things would really, really be bad. So actually, it's
how much
like,
worse could they get?
You know, it's slowed it down. I'm not saying that that's true, but I'm just offering as a suggestion that people might say that. And this is the reason why I wanted to come back to those very specific cases, because I think you really, in specific terms, debunk that claim.
Yeah, I mean, look. We're using more animals now in more horrific ways than at any point in human history. So, you know, we've had animal welfare. I mean, it's not, some folks, you know, there's sort of like a revolving membership in this phenomenon called the animal rights movement. You know, sort of people, you know, new people coming in and then, you know, they get disgusted and they leave, and then a new group comes in and then they get disgusted and leave. And, you know, the new group that comes in always sort of thinks that animal welfare is something that we came up with 3 weeks ago and let's give it a chance. And the answer is no, it's been around for 200 years and it's had a very, very strong presence in Western civilization. It's had a very, very, and I don't mean to say, there are different sort of ways of looking at things in places like India and China and whatnot, so I just want to confine my comments to Western thinking and Western philosophy. We've had this phenomenon called the animal welfare movement since, you know, for a couple hundred years now, basically, since the utilitarians, Jeremy Bentham and John Mill and those folks started saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we ought to give women the right to vote, we ought to get rid of slavery, and we ought to stop, you know, abusing animals and things like that. It was part of, you know, animal welfare sort of emerged as part of a progressive social movement in the 19th century. And so we've had it for a couple hundred years, and it's been a very, very strong presence for a couple hundred years, and it hasn't really gotten us anywhere at all. And what we must understand is animals are property, they're economic commodities. But they're different from other pieces of property we own because, unlike our stereos, cars, bicycles, and other things, they have interests. They have preferences, desires, and wants, which our inanimate property doesn't have. And to the extent that we protect those interests, it costs money. And so what ends up happening is the standard of animal welfare gets linked very, very much with the level of protection that is needed to efficiently exploit the animals, particular animals for particular purposes, by which I mean we protect animal interests only to the extent that we get an economic benefit from doing so, by and large. I mean, you know, there are some minor exceptions to this, but by and large, that rule holds. And it makes perfect sense, because if we spend more money, if we protect animal interests more and we spend more money on animal interests, then what we're doing, we're acting in an economically inefficient way. And we can't do that, particularly in a world where we have these free trade agreements and there's a lot of competition and whatnot. That simply doesn't work. I mean, there are all sorts of practical problems that come up. I mean, for example, it doesn't really matter whether a country in Western Europe gets rid of egg batteries. It doesn't really matter, because under the rules of the European Economic Community, that country cannot stop the import of eggs from a country that doesn't use battery. It doesn't have battery eggs. So although by 2012 they're supposed to get rid of battery eggs, even though they allow these things called enriched cages, which are basically battery cages. But, you know, under the EEC rules, the countries that are members of the European Union are supposed to get rid of conventional battery cages by 2012. Now that's not going to happen because there are a lot of countries in the European Union, and a very small percentage have even started to implement this directive, and it's not going to happen by 2012. But it doesn't really matter, because to the extent that you know, country X diminishes its production of battery eggs or goes to enriched cages, which again presents all sorts of welfare problems. The eggs can be brought from a country that has lower standards, and you can't stop it under the rules of the European Community. You cannot stop the import of those eggs on the basis that they're produced under a lower welfare standard. Same problem with NAFTA, GATT, all these free trade agreements basically say that you can't have barriers to trade based on these sorts of considerations. And so the economic pressure has, if anything, has intensified so that if you spend more money on protecting animal interests, you're going to be at a severe competitive disadvantage. You may be able to appeal to a niche market of affluent, elitist people who have money and who claim to care about animals but want to continue to eat them. You may be able to appeal to that niche market and make some money. But by and large, you aren't going to be able to feed lots and lots of people that way, and you're going to be at a competitive disadvantage. So the argument that I have and that I discuss in the book is, look, if you look at animal welfare standards, you see that they are pegged to efficient exploitation, that basically we don't protect animal interests except when we get an economic benefit from doing so. So for those people who would argue, well, if we didn't have animal welfare, we wouldn't have, you know, the level of protection that we have, things would be worse. The answer is no, they wouldn't. They really wouldn't be. Because all the animal welfare standards do is require that the owners of animal property act in a rational way and that they don't inflict gratuitous suffering on their property, which rational property owners wouldn't do anyway because they wouldn't get it. I mean, why would you take a hammer and go out and start smashing your car? If you're rational, if you're not insane, only crazy people do that sort of thing. I mean, you wouldn't do that sort of thing because you would be injuring, you would be diminishing the value of your property, and you wouldn't be getting anything from it. I mean, unless you had some perverse satisfaction, but you wouldn't be getting anything from it. Similarly, why would you use methods which are inefficient, which cost you more money than alternative methods, which cost you less money? And so what ends up happening is the animal people, the animal groups, they go around and they're looking for procedures and processes which are not economically efficient. We're seeing this now, for example, in Canada with this the controlled atmosphere killing business with Kentucky Fried Chicken. That is a perfect example. The electrical stunning of chickens is on its way out. The agricultural economic studies indicate quite clearly that controlled atmosphere stunning or controlled atmosphere killing are economically more efficient ways of killing animals. Yes, there's a capital cost, but after you deal with that initial capital cost, which you can recoup, basically, the studies in Europe have indicated that British producers that have gone to these alternative methods like controlled atmosphere stunning and killing are recouping their capital investment in about a year. After you recoup that capital investment, you are making a lot more money than you are making with the electrical stunning method because there's less carcass damage, there are fewer worker injuries, there are a lot of economic advantages to controlled atmosphere stunning. So what happens is you have people in these animal groups, and you know they employ people who read journals and identify practices that are being questioned by people within the agricultural community as being economically inefficient, and then these groups start campaigns against these processes. And then, although there's initially a reaction, a negative reaction from the industry, because industry doesn't want to be told, because industry, you know, is still processing the information, but that where there's movement in the industry towards getting rid of a practice, gestation crates, veal crates, these are all procedures and processes and practices which are not economically efficient. Alternatives to these processes and to these practices will actually result in greater profit for producers. And so you have the animal people who identify these things, target them in these campaigns, and then when they win, or when the practices change, which it was going to change anyway, they declare victory, and then you get 80 million solicitations to give your money because there's been this great victory. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you know, what the animal movement has become, Lauren, is it has become an informational tool for animal exploiters. What animal groups do is they go to industry and they say, look, we're collecting information and we think you ought to change this practice because it appears as though it's economically inefficient. There's, you know, this is a win-win situation. We'll be able to claim that animals are being protected more. You'll be able to claim that you care about animals more. And you'll make more money. And, you know, so they negotiate these things. And it was comical in Florida. HSUS and Farm Sanctuary spent how much money, a lot of money, on a campaign against gestation crates. There were basically two producers in the entire state who were still using gestation crates, and both of them were basically in the process of going out of business, and they were eligible for considerable state stipends because they were closing down their businesses. But there wasn't widespread use of the gestation crate anyway. I mean, everybody is recognizing that electrical self-feeding is an economically more productive way of doing this, of engaging in this form of exploitation. So really, these welfarist campaigns are worthless. They are worthless. They are not resulting in greater protection for animals. What they are doing is they are enriching these organizations, and they are making people feel better about animal exploitation. Because now they can go to Whole Foods, which has, you know, which has been given awards by PETA, and which John Mackey's been on the cover of Veg News, and John Mackey has gotten an award from Veg News, and all of this sort of stuff. So they can go to Whole Foods now, and as I was yesterday, I went there yesterday to pick up some vegetables, and Anna and I were remarking on the large sign they had by the meat counter about how they care about the happiness and well-being of their animals, and all of their suppliers are committed to giving these animals a great life. And, you know, and they've got a huge meat section and a huge fish section. And there are all these people buying this stuff thinking, hell, I'm an animal rights activist. You know, I'm buying my meat at a store that's gotten an award from PETA.
I just want to stop you there for a second. I think it's interesting that you bring up Whole Foods for a bunch of different reasons.
Yep.
But, I'm not sure if you're aware, but I'm currently finishing my PhD in environmental studies, and it's been a really interesting place to kind of bring up animal issues.
Yep.
And part of what Whole Foods does too is not only can you position yourself as an animal rights person, but you can position yourself as an environmentalist too.
Absolutely.
No.
They're ringing all the bells, Lauren. They're ringing all the bells. I mean, it is really brilliant what they're doing. I mean, But all of these organizations do the same thing. I mean, you know, you have Kentucky Fried Chicken coming out, you know, and arm in arm with PETA. We all care about animal welfare. We all care about, you know, the environment. You know, this is marketing. It's pure and simple. It's marketing.
In relation to sentience, though, because this is the core, really,
yep,
of what you're talking about. I think that one of the most difficult things for people who are truly interested in the type of theory that you're talking about, from my perspective anyway, insulated within the academy to some degree in the environmental discourse, is that by focusing on sentience as being the only criteria that really matters ultimately, environmental discourse says, well, you're basically then casting all other non-human nature into the realm of resources, that this is kind of an overprivileging of sentience, which results then in this exclusion of other non-human nature.
Well, I mean, look, I do think that there's a difference between a dog or a chicken or a fish and a plant. Are plants alive? Yes. Do they have minds? Not as far as we know. Is there anyone there who cares about what happens to him or her? And the answer is not as far as we know. Might we be wrong? Yeah, possibly, but probably not. So, yeah, I do think that there's a huge difference. Plants are alive and dogs are alive, but there's an enormous difference between a plant and a dog. The dog is the same as I am in terms of we are both sentient, and we are alike in a very relevant respect and unlike everything else in the universe, including things which are alive but not sentient. Now, let me say this. I think that you're raising an interesting question. Problem I have with starting to talk about, you know, the moral value of plants or the inherent value of plants and that sort of thing is that whenever you start engaging in that discourse, animals get put over on the side of the plants as things that we should use but use respectfully. And that is the problem I have, is that it's one of the problems I have. I mean, I think there's a conceptual problem because I don't think plants have minds, whereas I think anything sentient, it has a mind and is... there is someone there who cares about what happens to him or her. I do not believe that the sprouts that I ate this morning for breakfast, I don't believe that any of those sprouts cared about whether I ate them. I don't believe that there was anyone there who had an interest in my not eating that particular sprout.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I think for me, that is an extremely important point. But I would also say that, look, if we all took seriously the not eating animals, and we all really took veganism seriously, we would have many fewer problems with the environment. I mean, it is animal agriculture, which is the largest source of greenhouse a problem, much more so than the use of fossil fuels for transport. So, I mean, you know, by taking veganism seriously, which is basically, you know, a central argument of the book, I mean, the book really is sort of the philosophical foundation of veganism. Why, if you care about animals, vegetarianism isn't enough. Being a flexible vegan is not enough. Veganism, that's the only thing that makes sense if you take animal interests seriously. Mm-hmm. If we took animal interests seriously, if we regarded them as persons, if we stopped exploiting them, if we stopped eating them, wearing them, and using them, the environmental impact would be magnificent. Whereas what concerns me as a political matter is, if we regard animals as being like the leaves and the trees and everything else, that worries me, because then they become resources. Because the bottom line is the most ardent environmentalist or ecologist I know still regards those plants and those systems, the ecological systems, they regard them as resources. There may be huge differences between the non-ecologist and the ecologist, or between the deep ecologist and the environmental, you know, whatever. There may be deep differences about what level of respect is owed, or what level of care must be exercised in order to utilize those resources in a morally acceptable way. But make no mistake about it, they all still regard them as resources, as things that we can use. And my view is that animals don't fall into that category. And look, I mean, I think that these issues are terribly interrelated. I mean, yes, I do regard the environment basically as a resource, but I also see it as, we ought not to be cutting down the tree, not because the tree cares if we cut the tree down. As far as I know, there's no one there that cares about whether I cut the tree down. The animals that live in the tree care, the squirrels and the birds and everybody else. I mean, the sentient beings who live there, they care. Mm-hmm. You might care because you need to use that tree for some other purpose that's more important for the frivolous purpose that I want to use it for. And you know, there can be all sorts of reasons why we ought not to cut down the tree in terms of obligations that we owe to other sentient beings, human and non-human, with respect to global warming issues or other sorts of issues. But I have never understood, and believe me, I've tried, I have never understood the concept of an obligation to a non-sentient being. Mm. I can have an obligation to you not to eat the lettuce because you are hungrier, that you are more hungry than I am, and it would be better for you to eat the lettuce than me. But to talk about my obligations to the lettuce is something I don't even understand what that means. As a locution, I don't even understand what that means.
I think there's too the sense that the self-righteous vegan who feels that he or she has fulfilled their moral obligation, and they might be drinking chocolate soy milk with non-fair trade chocolate that from a GMO soybean, and there's this push back towards veganism that says, well, you guys have neglected, or potentially with your freeze-dried soy meats or whatever else, you've neglected really an accountability to environmental issues more broadly.
Well, Lauren, you could say the same thing about any moral issue. You could say, if I'm interested in child abuse, and I'm a campaigner against, you know, the exploitation of children, you know, I'm still not living a perfect moral life because, you know, I'm not a vegan, or I'm not, I mean, you can say that about anything. You can always say, well, vegans are not being as environmentally conscious. Well, you know what? Okay, that may be true, and we all ought to be environmentally conscious, and we ought to be conscious about human rights issues, and we ought to be conscious about a whole range of issues. What concerns me is the non-vegan who basically says, oh, well, you know, you, vegan, are being elitist because you think everybody should be vegan. And the answer is, I think the elitism is really with the non-vegan. I mean, it's primarily with the non-vegan, because I don't believe that we can justify the exploitation of animals. I think it's the ultimate elitism, the idea that anybody thinks it's okay to eat ice cream because they like the taste of ice cream. That, to me, and again, I'm not making moral judgments about individuals. I'm talking about a way of thinking. That's a bully way of thinking. It's like, my taste matters more than the suffering of that cow and what that cow went through to make this, you know, for me to get this product. Having said that, we all ought to be more conscious about a whole range of moral issues. But what concerns me is the sort of the attack on vegans that we're seeing coming basically from non-vegans and people who don't want to confront the problem of, you know, I have to be honest with you. I teach in a law school. I encounter lots of folks, you know, and who are interested in environmental issues. Somebody starts talking to me about ecology, and I ask, the first thing I say is, are you vegan? And when they say no, immediately what I think in my mind is, this is not a serious person. This is somebody who thinks social activism is putting a Free Tibet sticker on the back of your car, which I don't regard as particularly meaningful in the grand scheme of things. But I did want to tell you, before we ran out of time, that Columbia University is just about to announce, and we'll make a formal announcement, that there's going to be a new series on animal issues and animals and culture, and that's really significant, because Columbia University is one of the most, I think, prestigious presses, at least in the United States and probably in the world, and I'm going to be editing it with Gary Steiner, who's the chair of the philosophy department at Bucknell University, and so he and I are going to be editing a series, and also I'm going to be doing a new book with Columbia called Animal Rights versus Animal Welfare, and I'm going to be debating a prominent animal welfareist whose identity will become known when he decides to disclose it, and we're going to be doing a debate book about animal rights versus animal welfare.
Great, fantastic. Would you like to plug your website?
Yes, it's www.abolitionistapproach.com. People can go there and they can be educated in all sorts of ways. That's the most important thing. Nonviolent, creative, vegan education. That's how we're going to change the world.
Gary, thank you for being on the program. I really enjoyed this book. I thought the collections were very lucid, accessible, interesting, very relevant, and I just really appreciated, again, just for my own work, the very careful critiques that you do of some of the current welfare measures that have taken.
Didn't they do a nice job designing that cover? I thought Lisa Ham did a wonderful job. That picture, that dog on the front, is one of the dogs we rescued.
And I'm really glad that you dedicated it to your dogs and your hamsters, too.
Indeed,
two
indeed.
Hamsters.
They have taught me so much, I can't thank them enough. You take care. Thank you very much for having me as a guest. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Gary.
Take
Bye.
Care. Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Gary Francione. Interesting interview. Gary L. Francione is a distinguished professor of law and the Nicholas D. Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University School of Law in Newark. We were talking with him about a book called Animals as Persons. It's his most recent book, Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. There's tons of interviews on his website. Of course, we have lots of interviews with Gary Francione as well on animalvoices.ca. Thanks for tuning in, and of course, stay tuned for Das Mundo's coming up with Sergio. And thanks, Carl, for teching and bringing us the news.